Maura, do you remember the cat's name in the story?
I just remember the cat's name is Kajaruriya, and that means hurry up and die soon so you can be born a human and become liberated.
Aww.
How do you say that name again?
Kajaruriya. Reverend Basin said that it's something in Korean, but he said basically what it means is, you know, it's okay if you die because you'll have a fortunate, perhaps you'll have the opportunity to have a fortunate human birth, which is the only birth that can have liberation from samsara.
It's an auspicious birth.
Well, we're probably the only ones who have samsara. Cats and dogs probably don't.
Not that cat. That's the luckiest
no,
cat in the world.
Cat does not have samsara. It's a very trusting, open-hearted animal.
He likes to eat birds and mice, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. He loves belly cuts.
A little hedonistic, you know. Yeah.
Is it gray and white?
Black and white. Or maybe dark brown. Multicolored.
Land like this, and the one is long-legged and gallopy, and the other has very short legs, and he's a little fat. And
he's not a little fat, one.
No, they're after cats. Oh, and they go out as soon as, you know, they're out all night long under the door. I mean, they're in and out, you know, but they go out in the morning, and the one gallops, you know. The rogue's falling out of trees and off roofs, and and there's always debris in the sunroom when I come home, and feathers and all kinds of things. At night, 4 o'clock, you'll hear. And this is the last one you have. And I'll turn on the light, and the black and white one is playing with the mouse, and the orange fat one just sits watching.
Is everyone here?
Kevin.
Come on, it's not like, yes. Who's ever not here, let me know. So welcome, everyone. And is everyone well and at peace? The facility is treating you well also? Okay, good. Maura has an announcement.
I keep forgetting, as is John and I keep forgetting to ask formally. So we have two meals today. And we need 2 volunteers per meal for kitchen cleanup. So lunch, 2 volunteers, Matt, Ron. Okay, Matt, Ron, we have lunch, and then dinner, Liz and Lorna, beautiful. And then tomorrow for breakfast and lunch, we have the same thing, but very good. We'll just deal with 2 for right now. Okay. Not this my mind at all.
Thank you, Mark.
And then if somebody doesn't remember to remind,
The facility, just so you know, the facility did not request that. They did last year, but they didn't bring it up this year, but I think it's a nice thing to do. They normally charge groups to use the main hall now, but Karen told me that they wouldn't do it this year for our group. So they're being very generous to us. And they are. I mean, they just do a wonderful job, don't they? So.
Thomas, there a gift at the end?
Well, I don't remember what we did. Did we... did we
give them? We clapped for, thank them. I think.
Yeah. Well, we acknowledged the especially the kitchen staff. We asked them to come out, and we I gave him a little speech and a little bow. We all did. And I think that's enough.
Yeah, I mean, there are donation boxes everywhere if anyone is inclined to support the center, because the center, I think the one guy, Alan, who was working on the pathway yesterday, said that they spent so much time trying to figure out what would be the least expensive solution to that path, and durable and da-da-da, so they got... The wood alone was $10,000, just for the wood alone. Yeah, and the nails and the hardware and such like that. So all the labor is donated. They looked at stone, pavement, you know, all these other options. So
here?
Pressure treated.
Yeah. And they have the lights in it and such like that. So anyway, I'm just... putting that, they're not to get off in that, but if you want to, that's all.
Thank you. So how is your integration of the Eightfold Path, and in particularly right speech? Anybody have any comments on it, how it's working, how it's helping? Okay. Well, again, just continue to be mindful of right speech in the entire Eightfold Path, and... be mindful that every time that you practice restraint, you're supporting the rest of the Sangha in right speech, and then the rest of it more.
I would just say the other aspects on right intention and right mindfulness, I've noticed because of, you know, quiet, and as distractions fall away, just walking from place to place, you know, using the bathroom, everything, like just staying present with what's arising, it's a lot easier to, you know, to get to just notice, let thinking drop to the background and stay with sensation, and, you know, let go of clinging and noticing when clinging is arising and falling away. So I would say that.
And also the physical place here and the lack of distractions here. Just the, you know, how everything is simple, clean, straight.
No pictures.
Well thought out.
Makes it easier to be mindful, to treat it well, to do right action. It's a working program.
They predicted a big, great storm today. In fact, they said there's a chance of tornadoes even here, and it doesn't look like it. Maybe we'll just be like this. What I'm bringing up is, if it's raining heavily tonight, maybe it's better to just stay here instead of walking over in the rain to the main hall. But if you feel strongly about it,
the main hall is pretty beautiful.
It is. One of the attractions is when we're there during sunset and just looking out over the mountains, but there won't be much of a sunset tonight,
I
don't think.
It might be a pretty neat place to be during a storm, though.
Well, I'm driving over, so... if you don't mind walking over in the rain, we'll just leave it the way
it is. What's the schedule? Is it dinner at 5:30 and then 6:30, 7?
Yeah, we could just, after dinner, we can just gather over there when we're all together.
It's really hard at home.
Unless it's a holiday.
I looked at the map, and it is...
Which it could be.
Right, it's really pretty hard.
Okay.
Just stay down. We have to go down there for dinner.
So all right, so we'll just stay there. Then we're going to come back here, and we'll have a little get together tonight. You know.
I'll
come back and forth. I can fit three other people in the car.
And
so
I'm sure if it's like downpour crazy, somebody else could take their car.
Yeah, sure. Right. I brought my umbrella.
Okay, so that's settled. We'll continue to schedule as planned. Any other logistical thing or anything anybody wants to talk about before we meditate?
Well, I just want to say that for me, right speech, I really notice that it's, you know, I conserve so much energy speech, and how much wasted energy occurs when I'm, you know, not in right speech.
Yeah.
So.
You make
it just necessary.
It's such a great point, and that energy that's not wasted in idle chatter can go into our meditation practice. We're simply not tired at the end of the day like we might be. We have energy to actually sit and be mindful of what's occurring. It's all a very cohesive practice. And even when you're practicing and develop right speech, you'll notice that your mind isn't always chattering, trying to come up with something next to say or something brilliant to say. You're just at peace because you know you don't have to talk. It's much more of a spontaneous and mindful interchange. So I'm encouraging you to continue with your right speech and develop it even further.
And your grocery bills can be less.
Really?
Because you're using less energy, so you actually you're taking in less food. Yeah. I mean, has anybody noticed that they're eating less in the meal?
I have noticed that.
I've been eating a lot.
But it's really good food.
It's really good food.
It's teaching. Yeah.
Even though it's the same amount as I would take,
right?
And I'm not interested in finishing it, so.
Outside of here, definitely eating less.
Yeah, that's what Jen just wanted to share that.
I actually, because I'm obsessed with my eating habits, when I get into the hall, there's a lot happening in my mind. So I'm noticing each individual thought with regard to food, you know, each clinging thought with regard to food, and I've noticed that initially I was taking more than I needed to, and then I started taking less, and I'm actually still taking more than what I actually need.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I would have discovered that at all if I wasn't in this situation, because I am, even here where there's no talking, and I'm in this kind of container that's guiding me towards right, or, you know, guiding me into right intention, still was behaviorally stuck in this, I have to take more food, right? Mm-hmm. I have to take more. And then slowly, like, as the days have gone by, I've been able to kind of break individual habits. Okay, don't take as much, don't eat as much, don't, you know, so. That's been my experience. And also, I'm not as interested. Because we're sitting. I'm not running and burning calories with stress.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for saying that, Jen. You're describing the practical application of mindfulness. And in your particular case, the issues coming up around taking too much food, and you're able to be mindful of it for a lot of reasons. But it's the reason why this retreat is structured the way it is, so that you can be mindful of mundane activities that you otherwise wouldn't be. And now think about if we weren't practicing right speech. You'd be in line and talking with someone and thinking that you must relate to someone to be social, and you wouldn't even have the opportunity to have that mindful thought of restraint.
Yeah.
And once we begin to practice restraint in one area of our life, we find that we're practicing it in all areas of life. That's where the resistance to the Dhamma often comes from. We don't even know how to apply it because we never have the real opportunity to do it. And once we do it, we really do see how simple and direct it is. It's right here, right now.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a situation. I normally take a big bowl of food, but right now I'm thinking mindfully, and I don't need all that. And that's the thought process. That's a well-concentrated mind that has developed a refined mindfulness of right view. How do I see this in right view? Mm-hmm. I don't need all. It's simple. I don't need all that food.
Oh, I can always go back.
And you can always go back. Yep, I did. But again, I filled my bowl up, you know, maybe halfway, thinking this is enough. Let me see if it's enough, and it wasn't because it was so good. And I went back and got a little bit more. You know. But in the past, I never had a real big problem with food, even though there were plenty of times when I ate more than I should. But in the past, I would fill up the bowl,
right,
just thinking, oh, I'm going to make sure I got enough. instead of walking back. So in all areas of our lives, it's important to, this is what the Buddha meant by ahepasika, come and see for yourself. It's important to recognize the simple but profound application of the Dhamma.
Yeah, I'd also say with the Qigong of the mindfulness of being in the body and eating in silence in combination, you're actually feeling your fullness.
Yeah.
You're recognizing your fullness, and I'm able to say, you know, I'm full.
Yeah.
And I don't need anymore.
Yeah. Again,
you don't want to be too full when you come back into meditate.
It's all of that.
That fullness is our way of distracting ourselves from what's really occurring in our body, and then we miss our life. So here we get to be, you know, fine, you know, in tune with what is actually appropriate, what isn't, and kind of what I've noticed, and in the past too, just literally the amount of food that we need is really decreased because energetically we're not burning calories on other
stress things. Yeah.
And we're taking in energy from, like I always feel like it's like a self-sustaining, you know, situation where you're bringing in chi and you're washing, and then there's just not that much needed to sustain the body. So your grocery bills really will be less.
On the subject of the energy, though, I mean, the output Matt and I were talking about yesterday, I mean, we're kind of tired, like we said, you know, we're just sitting, but that's a lot of concentration.
It was so nice.
It's not a fatigue when you're hungry, but it's a used your mind a lot.
Meditation done properly, the way we do it, requires energy. It's a time to relax, but mindfully relax. It's not a time to go to sleep. Lauren.
Just to go back to the food, I think because the food is so healthy, I can relax eating it because it's already been pre-worked out for me.
That's another.
It's a healthy diet, so I can take a bit of this, a bit of that, a bit of the other, just go down the line and just take a bit of this bit and try a bit of everything and enjoy a bit of everything.
Mm.
And for me, it's just a relaxed way of, rather than thinking if you go to, you know, somewhere and there's bagels and, you know, all that sort of more fattening food, donuts and stuff. That gives me agitation because I don't really want to eat that. Mm-hmm. I don't eat that at home. Mm-hmm. I eat this at home. Mm-hmm. And so just the fact that it's the health side is pre-worked out for me.
Yeah.
I can just go take it and be relaxed about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's my attitude to eating here. Just relaxing and enjoying.
It is. And that, again, they do their part in creating a really good environment for a retreat too, and that's one of it. There's other places that I looked at, and a few places I rejected simply because of the kitchen that they have here. It just doesn't conduce itself to what we're looking for here. Mm-hmm. Helen, you had something?
I just wanted to say, Laura and I were talking this morning about one aspect of it was right speech, and about if you're in a situation where there are a lot of people using wrong speech or it's just idle speech, and how you kind of have choices. You can either not participate at all,
mm-hmm.
or you can go and sort of be there marginally so that you're not trying to act exclusive, or you can, because it's sort of idle talk and doesn't have a lot of depth to it, it can be diverted. So if you start to inject another subject, maybe you can grab the rudder and steer it in a different direction.
Okay.
So we have choices, and we can use them, and sometimes they'll make a difference and sometimes they won't, but the best thing you can do is be authentic to yourself and not cross a line, as we were talking about a lot the other day, about to just be a part of something else, to be included, you know, in whatever's going on around you.
Yeah, that's all right. A simple way to recognize right speech that's leading to I-making is when you find yourself saying, my this. my job, my spouse, my dog, my cat. Even though the subject is someone else that you're usually talking about, what you're really talking about, what you're referring to is yourself. And that's just a good general way of recognizing it. And remember that we don't... The most profound experiences are when we can be with another person or a group in silence and not be uncomfortable about it, not feel like we need to... And just to be quiet. And yeah. What is that? What are you doing then in that situation? You're simply being mindfully present with each other and you're okay. Mm-hmm. Nobody needs to say, my this. Mm-hmm. You know? Laura? Did you have your hand up?
I didn't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We were also laughing about what the name of the phone is.
Oh, yeah.
The iPhone. and has one thing led to more idle chatter than an iPhone and smartphones in general? Wow. Jen?
Yeah, what I was going to say in terms of right speech, when you're in a conversation with one person who's eye making, they're talking directly to me, and noble silence is very helpful because it's just listening.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, eventually, they just kind of burn out.
Yeah.
Of the eye making, but also in those little spaces, you can ask them, you can point out what's happening right now, or you can ask them what's happening for them right now.
Yep.
And that, right, then it's not, what's the other definition of right speech? Not speaking in a way that is
going to
make them eye make or make me.
Yeah, you don't want to. A lot of times, in those situations, because we might be uncomfortable, we'll start asking questions, drawing them out even further,
right.
Rather meaning leading questions, mm-hmm. It's just to keep the conversation going because we think that that's what we should be doing as social beings. And so it's not appropriate to just ignore someone, but it's a fine line, or that's not a fine line. It takes some skill to direct someone who is stuck in eye making, and I'm saying it never happens with this group in the sangha, but occasionally someone does come that really, and they're usually new, but they're intent on doing that, and I'll usually bring it back gently to what we're doing here. I'll just remind, and I'll usually say it as a group announcement. This is what we do here, instead of singling someone out. And then to sit quietly. The example, one of the reasons why I learned to be such an incredible teacher is really seeing how the Buddha taught. I mean, there's a lot of examples of that because we're reading the situation of the Buddha teaching. And at times, he would encounter the same problem all those many years ago. And usually his response was either... In the Pana Sutta, they talk about how he answers four ways that he answers questions. And one of them would be just a simple direct answer, yes or no. One would be a declarative statement, meaning it's this, and leave it at that. The other might be to ask the question, ask another question as a way of directing that. The question would direct that person towards more right speech. And then the fourth way to answer a question is to not answer the question, to just sit quietly. And as we develop some wisdom and understand the whole process, we'll know the right way to act in those situations. Kevin said the other day that right speech is really in some ways the doorway into the Dhamma, and that's like that for many people. Many of my students say the first thing that the first tool they utilize is right speech.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you apply it to the internal dialogue.
Especially. Yes. Yeah.
Because all of what we do is always accompanied by language, by
yep.
chatter.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And
yep.
once you start getting the spotlight on the language, on the chatter, then everything else gets lit up and saying, oh, this way, mm-hmm. no, that way.
Yeah.
When you do redirect things in class, Joan, it doesn't go unobserved because I learn from that. Like, I love seeing the new person come in and have some eye referencing going on, and I, in my mind, I say, I can't wait to see the transition. You know?
Yeah.
But
it's exciting to see
that. When we go around the room, you always, if someone moves off into a direction of negative self-talk or whatever it is, you're always able to have a kind word, and I don't mean that simply as a compliment, but as a way to sort of help them redirect. And in some cases, it's really profound. You can almost see them sort of sitting up straight. But I also wanted to thank Maura a lot for her cues during the meditation. I've been checking in with myself now as I meditate, and I stop and I straighten my spine and I think of, you know, the top of my head. Anyway, so it's
you can
nice.
Lay down the bark, Landry. That's the best way. But thank you, Liz. And I will say though, the reason I'm doing this is I've been on many retreats, and I will sometimes really end up not caring for myself and my body. And it's this stubborn, this is the first time I think ever that I have said, like, don't torture your body. Why do you do that? Because I'm going to sit like this the entire time.
Oh, because everybody else is expected to sit like
that.
Yeah,
so like, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, really,
there's
really
one form.
This is the most, I sat in this chair upstairs and I thought, I am going to sit in that chair and I feel great. So that's all. So when there's a time and a place, time, degree, conditions, right? To sit upright and alert, but thank you.
I'm going to bring a bag of pillows with me now on Tuesday night because this is, I just figured it out.
Just to make an important point,
like,
the meditation posture should be a posture that provides. The meditation posture should be. We're off the rails. Hello.
Feel well supported. Well supported, so that you can relax into the surface.
You need to realize. Well,
so what Maura is referring to at those other retreats is, and I haven't been on all of them, is there's one form, and it's usually just like this, and it looks great, and I kind of sit that way. I move around a little bit, but my form is certainly different than other forms, and it's older than some other forms and younger than some other forms. Everybody's different. The purpose of a meditation posture is to be comfortable, and some people find that comfort in a chair. Some people find it on the floor in a certain way. Some people use a back jack or this. The point is to find a posture that leads to concentration and mindfulness. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to be completely comfortable or laying down and falling asleep. So find a posture that keeps you alert but does not lead to physical discomfort as much as possible. So then, just because we were touching on the subject a little bit, and the reason why I teach the way I teach, and the reason why I hold retreats this way. To me, it doesn't make sense to retreat from the Dhamma and go into some ascetic practice. To me, that's just not useful. But also, there have been people that contacted me and said, you know, I'm really uncomfortable talking in a group, and some people have said, I just don't like the time that it takes to do that, and that's fine. But I think it's so important to do just what Liz said, to give people an opportunity to say where they are for a few reasons. One is, so I know where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not getting feedback, I don't know if what I'm teaching has any value at all. And I don't know if people are getting lost in their heads. You know, so I think it's important that we all have an opportunity to say something and talk about our Dhamma experience. And I don't mean it in a cold way, but those people that don't like this, they don't like it. And this is not something I didn't spend feverish nights trying to figure out how I'm going to teach. I observed how the Buddha taught, how it's preserved in the Pali Canon, and this is what he did. Again, I'll say it maybe the third or fourth time. This is what we're experiencing right now is very similar to the first sangha.
It's funny, one clarification. What I said about the retreats was more during the lecture, during these periods. It's during these periods that I will sometimes still maintain a meditation posture. Nobody else's. So it's not, nobody said, well, everybody needs, everybody else is sitting around comfy. And I'm like, yeah, so that is something of an eye-making, self-imposed, ridiculous, not kind and gentle. So that was that. I decided during the non-meditation periods I was going to take care of my body well and what it needed. And then the second thing, I won't be able to do it correctly, but I was reading that book, The Book of Eights, and this book that has some, maybe it was an early text, maybe it wasn't, and blah, blah, blah. But in the, it's thought of to be one of the very early books. And in the last, I just read the last little chapter. It's like a poem about kind of, anyway. But they, in there, he pointed out that there was this difference. The last poem was like to the monastics. And it was out of character with the rest of the teachings. Just like you say, the authentication of the Pali Canon, there was no, the Buddha didn't say, according to this, I'm not going to do it well, like, he didn't tell the monastics what to do. He talked about what one doesn't do as a practitioner of the Dhamma, kind of in line with letting go and this and that, and he didn't give directions about what to do other than the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. So all of a sudden this, like what, so what you keep referring to, that this forum is more in line with what was actually occurring in the Buddha's lifetime.
Yeah, so we want to thank you for bringing that up. It's an important point. So we've all talked about how we develop
the precepts weren't there. That's
how we
mean,
develop the Eightfold Path, which is the same path for all of us. But how we, I don't want to use the word adapt, how we use our own individual conditioned thinking in relation to the path. In other words, we bring every individual conditioned thoughts that we have are just that, they're individual. But the path provides the framework for us all to reach that same conclusion. And so people would think that meditation is the biggest thing that the Buddha ever taught, and it's an important and certainly a large part of the practice. But you'll find very little instruction on, and you'll never find it under, there's no title for meditation as the Buddha taught. This is my meditation method. You do this, 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 this. You sit a certain way. His instruction was go find the root of a tree or an empty hut, meaning go find a place of solitude. And then the true only instruction that he ever gave, besides recounting what he did in meditation, which was being mindful of his breath, is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness.
What about the Satipatthana Sutta?
Well, it's Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Okay. And in that, he teaches what we do. Be mindful of your breath and your body. That begins to quiet you. And then to be dispassionately mindful of as feelings arise, we recognize them. Good morning.
Hey, everyone.
Please come in.
Hi.
Am I in the right group?
No, they're in the big room.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Do you want to get there?
Yeah.
But
to be...
Because often on Saturday mornings,
there's a sign on the door.
Yeah, they meditate down here.
And then to simply be mindful of feelings as they arise. So when I give the instruction, I'm instructing you to do that. And then to be mindful that thoughts arise. Sometimes feelings drive thoughts, sometimes thoughts drive feelings. The point is to not get into them, not... Where is this feeling coming from? Or it might be anger, and you get into the whole scenario about why that person made you angry and how bad they are for doing it. Or you might get into the story in your head again, just to remind yourself, here I am caught in thoughts. What do? Come back to the sensation of breathing. And that fourth foundation of mindfulness is to simply notice where that process of either reacting to feelings and thoughts affected the quality of your mind, or, as importantly, to notice that you've been able to be dispassionate about feelings and thoughts, and it did not affect the quality of your mind, and you have a peaceful mind. At any rate, at the end of your meditation, to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state, or be at peace with the quality of your mind. And so if you, I don't know, maybe you don't know, maybe I should make more of a point. The instructions that I give in meditation to begin meditation, to recognize that you're caught up in your thoughts, come back to the sensation of breathing, is the instructions of four foundations of mindfulness in each meditation session. Which is, again, it's the only meditation method that the Buddha taught. He didn't get into posture. He didn't get into this or that. He didn't get into, even in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is often misrepresented. I don't want to get into it this morning. But he's really saying in the longer explanation that people use to say, well, the Buddha's teaching to use this breath and that breath. All he's saying is, when you find that you're having a deep breath, notice it and just use it. Don't exaggerate it. If you notice that you're having short breaths, just notice it. Where later schools and now modern mindfulness practices have run wild with that, and we create all these mindfulness meditation scenarios using the Satipatthana Sutta in a way that doesn't lead to concentration. In fact, it's just another TV show. It's just another distraction.
The only reason I mentioned the Satipatthana Sutta is you had said that the Buddha didn't mention meditation only in this. So I said, well, he did do a sutta on it. That was it, not to say that it was,
yep.
It's anything different than exactly what we do.
Yeah.
But there was a particular sutta based on the four foundations of mindfulness.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I said it. He didn't. You won't find anything, any chapter in any of the books saying the Buddha's meditation. But you will find those references to how to meditate. Find a root of a tree or an empty hut. Find solitude. That's one of the things I was going to talk about, so I might as well now, and then we'll meditate. This afternoon, we have the afternoon off. Probably not going to be able to walk around. So use that time to develop more solitude and enjoy the solitude that we have here. And if you can walk around, great. You know, that'd be wonderful. So why don't we meditate before...
It gives you a nice opportunity to work with the hindrance of boredom.
Yeah.
Seriously. Boredom is something probably, I know maybe for some men it's lust, but for women I think...
The lustiest people I ever met were the women that I met. That was usually in pretty darkly lit bars, but...
Lusty wenches.
So, all right, let's get back to the...
Evolutionary-wise, I think there is a little bit of a stronger... From what I've read.
From what you read.
I want to see your book list.
Yeah.
Well, I think that
you
have to do
that. Let me tell you a time when I was in the Red Witch down on West 4th Street. I was 19 years. Why don't we meditate?
With that image in mind.
Just to touch a little bit about... the meditation, what I was saying before, and the Buddha never gave any direct instruction, or called meditation. But he did talk about it, obviously. It's so important. And the other, another sutta that's important, I can't think, you might remember, it starts with a J, where he talks about shamatha vipassana in tandem and how that's the meditation method that he taught. It wasn't just mindfulness of the breath, and it certainly wasn't just insight. And that's
one of Ananda's suttas.
One of
Ananda's suttas. He
yeah, it starts with a J.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but I just read it. There are four.
I know, but I can't think of it.
There are four ways: either you first do have vipassana, then samatha, or you first have samatha, then vipassana, or you have them in tandem.
Well, always in tandem. That was the point of the.
Well, that particular one, he says, you can do, you can start with samatha and then move to vipassana, and then integrate vipassana, or you can start with vipassana and then integrate samatha, or you can do it in tandem. Now, the last one, I don't know what that would be. It can be neither.
No, but the point of the sutta is that a meditation practice is both of those.
Is both, correct.
And that's in the importance. Point of that is that we need to use a technique to quiet the mind, to develop concentration so that insight arises. But it's not the meditation, it's not during meditation or only during meditation that we should expect insight. Mm-hmm. That would preclude the rest of the path, wouldn't it? And it would just be a meditation practice. So often meditation leads to insight, things arise, but it's not something that's analytical. And again, the teaching or the story of the Buddha's own awakening. He didn't get into the analyzing these things that were coming up that Mara was throwing at him, using the metaphor Mara. He simply recognized them as impermanent, as parts of his self-referential views, and he simply, like he said in Nagara Sutta, and I simply abandoned them. He wasn't getting into analyzing these things, where they came from. It doesn't matter. And most of our insight comes, just like we've talked about, situational, as we're living our lives and within the framework of the Eightfold Path, and we gain insight into clinging to things. You know, that's, and ultimately, it's insight into the impermanent nature of all things, and insight into ongoing eye-making. Lorna.
I find that when I'm going about my life and I see insight, also judging. I see things in other people and think, okay, like, that's conditioned thinking, they're thinking. But I'm also judging.
Well, there, maybe not. There's a fine line there. There's a difference between observing what's in front of you and judging someone harshly. So if you're recognizing eye-making, and it just leads to compassion, you understand the suffering that they're creating for themselves and maybe others, that's just a wise observation. If you're seeing eye-making or arrogance in someone else, and that leads you to say, what a so-and-so,
yeah,
that's judging.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing?
Judgment.
Stop it.
the two go together often for me.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be flippant. I'm sorry for that. What's important is that you're recognizing it in yourself. And how else could you change it if you didn't at first recognize it? So that's the beginning of letting go of even that judgment. You know?
That's the one thing that human beings share. That is our one commonality. So we're not all one, but we all share conditioned thinking and eye-making. So that's where compassion, I think, arises, is recognizing that I know until I am fully awakened, I am absolutely in that same cycle.
Yeah, that's so, right.
And what I want is, yeah, sorry. I mean, and what is helpful is a softening around that. And
it's either a harsh judgment, or you recognize where that's coming from the other person, because you understand it yourself. And it's not a judgment, it's just a mindful observation, which leads to compassion.
But we tend to project it out onto other people. I mean, we do.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's why there's all the trouble in the world. You know? So the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, to reset the stage. And I think I said last night that this was a sutta that he gave to 1,000 folks or so. Did I say that last night? Because what I'm referring to there is the fire discourse that we'll talk about tonight. Yeah. There's no date on any of this. So it's probably within a week or two of his first teaching, and it's still to those 5 folks that he was wandering around with. And again, this is a little bit of speculation or reading between the lines. But what I think he's observing now is the struggles that these 5 folks are having with self-referential views, with eye-making. And he's probably observing some discussions they're having in relation to the Eightfold Path. And so what happens to me when I develop this? And this is his talk on that. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. I just realized Jen walked out of the room. Why don't we wait for Jen to come back?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I noticed her walking out of the room, but it didn't register. So. And if anybody's wondering why we did a 20-minute meditation instead of 30 minutes, is anybody wondering?
I was.
Oh, good. Well, here's the answer. We just had a very interesting talk this morning, and I don't want to get too far into the day and give us a little bit of break between our end of our class this morning and lunch, or at least not run right up against lunch, so. That was why. Pardon me?
Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Can I just say something about what Lorna said?
Absolutely.
So I think sometimes when things are new for us and we think that we start to develop answers to things, we all see the suffering in others.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're coming from the point of view that I often come from, which is, you know, you want to help and repair and fix and, you know, all those things, those conditioned ways of thinking, that you feel like you might have something worthwhile to share with them, and that's when it starts to sound crazy, when you start to talk about what it is. No, I'm not as skillful in talking about. But maybe as you get further into it, you can start to say that and recognize more that you can't fix everyone, and then the judgment starts to fall away because you're not responsible for that person's transformation, and you're not all you can do is
fix yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you won't, at least you won't contribute to the suffering of others, and you'll be in a position to actually at times be helpful, truly helpful.
Right.
What set the Buddha out on his search was recognizing suffering, but also understanding at that point that he couldn't do anything about it either. What's interesting to me, I often talk about this, he was in a position of power where he could do something immediate. He could, you know, lavish some food or something, but he knew that that's not really the problem. But he didn't understand a solution yet. And it wasn't until he understood the solution that he began expressing his compassion married with wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
As an unawakened bodhisattva, he didn't do anything. You know, and that's not to say we shouldn't be helpful. We are. Human beings are naturally compassionate. But oftentimes we don't understand how to express that compassion because of a lot of conditioned thinking. We're looking at people as poor souls, which in a way that's a denigration. Right. Well, it can be, but it could be just a wise observation. The only way we can know that is if we have our thinking is coming from right view, because the same situation could be a judgment or it could be a wise assessment.
You always say to not judge ourselves harshly, and in the truth of happiness, I think early on it says, you know, just to go back to what you were saying, you know, you often use the words, you know, not to fix ourselves, but maybe we're developing an understanding. So the back there, you know, maybe because we're going to learn right now, there's clearly nothing to fix, right?
Yeah,
just developing the understanding and cultivating our wisdom.
Exactly. It's the big trap forever, you know, even during the Buddha's time, but certainly now, is to engage with something with the motivation that I'm so broken that I need to fix myself. What are you going to do? You're going to spend, if you believe in lifetimes, you're going to spend eons trying to fix something that ain't broke. It's like foam on the water.
And the Buddha said until his final awakening, he recognized ill will in his mind.
Yep. And Lorna was talking about
that. That's what I'm saying. That's my point, that none of this goes away until the very end. We might recognize it and see it and be at peace with it, but that's all that it's foam on the water.
Yep.
And that is very inspiring to me for the Buddha, you know, say you say it was, you know, eons of lifetimes or whatever, but, you know, that these things are just, as Matt had said the other day, they just come up and go away. They're just thoughts.
So when we
recognize, you know, which, you know, I spend an awful lot of time making judgments. It's just a reflexive thought. Be kind, gentle, just don't give it that much mind.
If you want to be truly helpful, that motivation that Maura was just talking about, get to it, like your hair's on fire. You know, that's, again, the Buddha's encouraging us in his teachings to also engage in determined right effort. You can accept the fact that, okay, I'm on this path, I know it's going to lead me to something, and that can even bring a kind of complacency. Yeah. But one of the reasons why we're all here this weekend is because we recognize now's the time. Now, like I just said before, I used to say that a lot. Now is the time to meditate. Now is the time to awaken. Why wait? Why put it off? There's an old Zen memorial. I used to say this often. Just a little Zen phrase. And it was, I can't remember who the actors were. But you might remember. But it was, so-and-so, are you awake? Yes, I am. Are you fully awake? Think about it, you know? Mm-hmm. Are you there yet?
Can I add one
okay,
thing?
But we got to get going.
The last thing is just that that I found very helpful, because when you start understanding some of this stuff, you see it all over the place, right? And I would be with my mom and I'd want her to stop whatever she was doing, and I'd be like, "Oh my God, I can't believe she's carrying on about this." And it might have been you, John, but somehow what I realized is to. You know, we always talk about being at peace with the people and the events of our lives. And when I just started to just love my mother and just love whoever it was, wherever they were, it was a lot less energy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you get to that turning point where you go, oh, it's just about
you saw another
being
side
kind.
Of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to everyone, just being kind, just allowing people to be where they're at. We don't need to get involved in
it. You get past the
question. Unless
there's a question.
Ask, you know, could I have some advice?
But that's not what you're referring to, is it, Lorna? You're just saying out in public. I'm sorry. Observation.
Just in general, yeah.
And so there's another component that needs to be... I'm sorry, Lorna, what were you saying?
I'm having to express myself very much. I mean, it's not all the time. What I'm making by a judgment is that I come to the realization about somebody, what they're doing, but there's a story attached to it. You know, the Buddha says that if you cognize only what you hear, I don't. I add a bit on. You know, whichever mind state I'm in, I'm sympathetic or I'm judgmental, whichever mind state I'm in has a reflection on what the add-on bit is. So that's just what I was meaning. I wasn't like going about my life, it's just the add-on bit was something I wish I could drop and just see.
Well,
I could see and leave it, but
You will, because you've developed the first stage. You developed the recognition of it, and the next thing is renunciation or letting it go, abandoning it. But you have to be there first, and you have to be mindful of it. You know, it's not something that you can't pass over these things. You know, that's the common phrase would be spiritual bypassing, getting to the compassionate stage without developing the recognition of why you're not compassionate all the time. If you jump there, if you try to create the scenario, I'm the most compassionate person, or just focus on just being compassionate, you miss the whole underlying reason why you're not always compassionate. So I was going to say something. Another important thing that, and I know we're really getting off this, but I'm not taking any more comments after this. It's also appropriate. We can fall into the trap that at 100% of the time, I should always be mindful and giving. And there's situations you're going to find yourself in, and we all have, where they're simply hurtful situations, or maybe even dangerous. And because we think that we're supposed to be the perfect bodhisattva now, we'll allow ourselves to get drawn into a situation I'm not just talking about physically hurtful, but it could be. Mm-hmm. Because we kind of lost our minds that way. But we're pushing too hard in a situation where we should recognize there's nothing I can do here. And it's entirely appropriate to just gracefully or otherwise remove yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really important. Remember, the Buddha was not a savior. He's not teaching a salvific religion. We're not supposed to leave here on Sunday morning and go save the world. Strive diligently for your own salvation, and then you can effectively work with others. So, and now we're going to talk about why we fall into, other people would fall into those situations of eye-making. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. There he addressed a group of five, his five buddies. And they are now bhikkhus because they're part of the path. They're part of the sangha now. They've created their first sangha. Bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering, and one could have it be any form desired. In other words, for anything that we can call self, we have to be in control of it. And we're not in control of form, are we? Then why would we identify it as a self? One could have it be any form desired and stress-free. Since form is not self, it leads to suffering. And none could have it be any form desired and stress-free. Bhikkhus, feeling is not self as perceptions are not self. Fabrications are not self and consciousness is not self. What is he referring to here, the five clinging aggregates? If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one could direct these aggregates as one wished. Again, we're not in control. What's a well-concentrated mind? It's a mind that's in control of itself. The Vitakasiddhanta Sutta concludes with, I can't stand not being able to see who I'm talking to. One big blur. The Vitakasiddhanta Sutta concludes with, you'll gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it, meaning appropriate thoughts appropriate to the situation you're in. You've gained control of your thinking. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent? The five replied, impermanent, venerable sir. Now, is what is impermanent painful or pleasant? They said painful, venerable sir. I'm going to say always painful, venerable sir. Whatever is impermanent that we attach ourselves to has to, at some point, create suffering in our lives. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? No, venerable sir. Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? That's such a good example of asking the appropriate question to draw, to start pointing someone in the right direction. So I'm going to go back over that. Just to recreate the scenario. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, subject to change? Is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? What an important question, isn't it? But they don't even realize how important it is. No, venerable sir. Well, is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent? So he's insisting that they see this thing clearly and make a determination in their own minds. All are impermanent, venerable sir. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, subject to change? Is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? No, venerable sir. So bhikkhus... Okay, I'm sorry. I'll go back then. Now, is what is impermanent... I'm getting excited about this. It's not because I'm crying. Because can't wait to get to the end. Wait till you get to the end.
So you're reading fast. It's important to read fast.
Now, is what is impermanent? What is painful? Is something? Thank you, Lorna. Now, is what is impermanent? What is painful? Since subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine? This is I. This is myself. No, venerable sir. So, bhikkhus, any kind of form, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external. And of course, he's talking about identifying or clinging to external objects. Whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding how it is, be regarded thus. This is not mine. This is not I. This is not myself.
It relates exactly to the conversation we were just having.
Yep. And so anytime you find yourself, this is such a direct and useful teaching, anytime you feel yourself caught up in the world, remind yourself, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself.
Fabrications.
Because if the feelings are coming up and they're creating agitation in yourself, or maybe reflecting that on others, you know that it's not you. You know that there's nothing nothing you should be taking personal here. It's foam on the ocean. No matter how intense it might be, no matter how real it might be, it's foam on the ocean. This is not me. Why? Because it's impermanent. How could it be you?
It's an ignorant moment.
It's only arising out of ignorance. Again, thank you for bringing it all the way back to what the Buddha awakened to and what this whole process is trying to teach us. It's all rooted in ignorance. I'll continue. I'll try to do it slowly. And so it follows that any kind of feeling, whatever. Now, feeling in this sense is it can be a mental or physical feeling, but it's really referring to any agitation in the mind, any movement in the mind that's rising out of that ignorance, any feeling. And so it follows that any kind of feeling, whatever, any kind of perception, any kind of fabrication or determination, any kind of consciousness, whatever, remember consciousness rooted in ignorance, any kind of consciousness, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding of how it is, be regarded thus. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower has heard the truth, he sees thus. He finds estrangement in form. He finds estrangement.
Estrangement of form.
No connection. This is strange to me. There's no reference to form anymore. Is that clear?
No clinging to it.
No clinging, yes, but
estrangement is kind of
It's like you meet a stranger for the first time. They're strange to you. You have no reference.
Connection.
There's no personal connection.
That's why I said clinging, because when you're estranged from somebody, you are no longer attached to that person.
I didn't hear what Lorna said.
The chocolate cake is not yours. You don't see yourself.
The chocolate cake is mine. But. Lorna, I didn't hear the last thing you said.
Oh, we're talking about everything in the world.
Yes.
A tree, like
yes.
A grass.
Yes.
A bird.
Yep.
A person.
And a good
feeling, but also sensations that arise within us.
Yes.
That too. It's everything. In the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha is referring to the world as dukkha, but also everything in the world when we're clinging to it. So a blade of grass isn't necessarily dukkha unless we identify with it and we like Kentucky bluegrass over rye. I mean, it's a silly example, but a perfect, it has to be perfect, everything, you know. Again, what a great example of it. It's something that is so mundane that we don't even realize that unless my lawn is cut every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, my whole weekend's shot to hell. You know, again, it's kind of a silly example. So yes, it is estrangement with everything in the world, but estrangement simply means what Maura pointed out. It simply means we're not clinging to things being different than they are. Is that clear?
What Jen said arises, is that what means what arises in us? And perhaps it's more accurate to say what arises in the mind, because us is an attachment to this form.
Well,
this
what he's talking about. Form, feeling, perceptions, the whole thing. I got a feeling that I didn't quite answer your question.
There's no movement in my mind by anything that I see.
Well, let me put it this way. There's only movement in your mind when you're self-identifying with the things that you see. And maybe I'm speculating here. In fact, I think I am in your case, because I can kind of see that you're not going here. But it's easy to go there with, well, how can I live in the world? Aren't I supposed to enjoy things? That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about enjoying things to the point where they're creating disturbance in your mind. And when we let go of all self-referential views, all clinging to things, more of them, less of them, maybe even neutral, we're creating a kind of mindlessness where we can't really appreciate what's going on. And so a good example of this might be having going through the death of someone we love. I know a lot of us can relate to that right now. And so we feel sadness because it's appropriate. But because of conditioned thinking, we say, no, I'm not supposed to feel sad. I'm supposed to be tough or whatever. The whole gambit of emotions that might follow from that. And all of that is conditioned thinking, and it takes us away from what's occurring, meaning I am estranged. The emotion that is arising from the situation, I am now estranged from. The emotion is a stranger to me, and I can be fully present with what's occurring.
Which it's is not me, which is, it's not mine, it's not self. It's
yes,
just what is occurring.
Which is
of pull.
Yes, another word would be it's an appropriate response for what's occurring in all situations. So again, we're not talking about becoming automatons, not having any feeling. In fact, I can tell you I can tell you from experience that you deeply feel things. In fact, feel things in a way that you'd never felt before. Because you're allowing yourself to feel, and it's appropriate for. And last night when I was talking to her, I'm going to cry again. I find myself doing that more often, but it's appropriate. I'm not embarrassed by it. It's just something that comes up. I did it last year in the hall too, and then it's gone. I want to finish this. Jen. I'm sorry. Please, ask any questions.
Yeah.
It's me that I want to get stay back in this, but let's ask the questions as we go along.
So I think I'm getting stuck. Probably overanalyzing. But early on, when you were reading what the Buddha said, that if we don't have, he was speaking to the monks, and he said, if I don't have control, or if you don't have control over it, then it's not self.
Yep.
How can it be self if we don't have control over it?
Yep.
I'm seeing the flip side of that and saying, if we have control over it, it is self. And I'm getting somehow.
Okay, it's a great question. Remember the context. Now he's talking about the self-referential ego self would try to control things that are impermanent. And how can you control anything? Meaning,
right. So it's with impermanence. I think the impermanence mm-hmm. is really where I need.
Yeah, and so thank you so much for asking the question, because that is kind of the confusing point in all of this. I remember I had a student a short while ago, maybe 6 months ago, and one of the first questions he said is, what's this big deal about impermanence? I know everything is impermanent. Everybody knows everything is impermanent. We do. But we don't apply it to ourselves. We don't realize that even though we have a general understanding that everything is impermanent, we still try to make a permanent self in that. And that's the brilliance that of the Buddha.
Yeah, it's impermanent.
Yeah, it's impermanent. It's again, it's like, you know, you're all a bunch of fools. I got it. Everything impermanent is happening to you, but I know I can establish a permanent self.
Yeah.
That's arrogance. That's I make it. So it's such a key point to understand in context what the Buddha's talking about. So the Buddha's a good example. An awakened human being still has a form, doesn't he or she? But they're simply no longer attached to it. They're no longer trying to control something that can't be controlled in that way, creating a scenario of it. So,
yeah,
so
that, that's what I got with the form, because I was like, well, I can control my form, though.
Well, you can
move around.
Yes, so I can get my form and walk out of here.
Right.
Not as well as I used to, but but I can. But I cannot control, to a great extent, sickness, aging, and death. I have no control over that.
Well, could you stop the cells from doing their mitochondrial activity? No.
Yeah.
Right.
Again, that
we need to switch the boards and look at the orange box and put it in the right over here.
Exactly. Well, yeah, this is what we're talking about right there. That's the process now. So we've gone from there to here.
I can't see it.
And if you look,
turn the light.
Even if you put it up, lean it against the bottom, and maybe next time go with a bigger font.
You could just drop that.
Or I just.
Well, maybe we'll take a donation box. And we'll blow these up one day.
That's good.
So, well, let me refer to that one when I finish the sutta. And there was something else I was going to say. So if you look on the bottom one now, impermanence allows for the interruption of the ongoing process of eye making. And how do we do it? What's the intervening interruption? Is the Eightfold Path. And again, that's what the Buddha is talking about here.
Can you say that one more time?
The dependent origination locks us into this constant regurgitation of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Unless something occurs that interrupts it. Or we just keep... It's the feedback loop that the Buddha talked about. And if there wasn't such a thing as impermanent, if all things, including the different aspects of dependent origination, especially the things that we identify as physical, if there wasn't impermanence in them, there'd be no way to interrupt the process, would there be? We would be stuck eternally in that feedback loop. But because of impermanence, we can interject an Eightfold Path that allows us to gain, here's the word, gain control of our thoughts. And so what then really defines a self is a being, use these words loosely, that has gained control of their thinking. That's the only thing we can control. And if we gain control of our thinking, then we no longer react to sickness, aging, and death. We no longer react to not getting what we want or getting what we don't want. We no longer react and create a personal experience of suffering through five clinging aggregates.
Yeah. But it's not really control of your thinking. It's making the right response to what you're thinking about.
That, yes.
What you hold in mind.
What you hold in
because
mind.
Because those thoughts are going to come, like Maura was saying before. The Buddha knew right till the very end that he's going to have the thoughts that he's going to be challenged by. So that it's not control over the thought, it's control over what you do with the thought once you have it.
It's right view.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's the...
He says with right understanding, it is with right understanding how it is. This is not mind,
right.
It's not self. So it's the Eightfold Path, as you're saying. You have to be mindful, aware, concentrated, right view.
Yes.
Right.
Because you can't possibly sit here and think that you have control over any of it. I mean, you don't.
That's the point of the sutta.
But
look at it. If you don't
view.
Have control over it, it can't be you.
Your view, you have control how you talk about it, you have control how your effort is towards it, but you can't stop the thoughts. You can.
Wait a minute.
Well, maybe that's what enlightenment is, when you can.
You gain control. Yes, that's that. You can stop the thoughts.
You're so.
Yeah, it's hard to understand that at first, because up until you can stop your thoughts or control your thoughts or direct your thoughts in the through right view, you're right. You can't. It seems like you have no control of your thoughts.
Right.
That's a difficulty with beginning meditators. It doesn't. How can you control this? But you can. You gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. It's such an incredibly profound statement, isn't it?
It is.
And it's achievable for every one of us.
It is just hard to believe sometimes.
Hard to believe is the right way. How can I believe this? You can't. The Buddha knows you can't believe this, but he knows you can experience it. If you take it on belief, you're going to be disappointed. But if you take it on the... If you take refuge in that a human being did this, the Buddha... And that he left his teaching the Dhamma, and we have a supportive Sangha. Yes, you can. You can have the direct experience of gaining. Again, I got to see what. You gain control. You gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. So, I lost my page. I'm going to go back to that. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower who has... Pardon me? Thank you. Bhikkhu. When a noble follower who has heard the truth sees thusly, he finds estrangement in form. He finds estrangement in feeling. He finds estrangement in perception. He finds estrangement in determination. He finds estrangement in consciousness. When he finds estrangement, passion fades out. With the fading of passion, he is liberated. When liberated, there is knowledge that he is liberated. He understands. Birth is exhausted. The integrated life has been lived. What can be done is done. There's nothing else to be done. Of this, there is no more beyond. So again, it's a phrase that we could get caught up on. What do you mean there's nothing beyond? Does it mean we're dead? There's nothing beyond this that can cause or becoming. There's nothing that can contribute to any further suffering, any further ignorance. We've let go of all self-referential views. Let me just conclude this. Now, during this discourse, the hearts and minds of the bhikkhus were liberated from craving, aversion, and deluded thinking. That's the end of the sutta. And it is said that the other four bhikkhus, remember, Kandana awakened at the first... teaching, they awakened at this point. And so now there's I was going to say five, there's six awakened beings in the world. From those two very succinct teachings, but in those two teachings he explained the nature of the problem and how we create self-referential clinging through that. Mm-hmm. And their minds were liberated. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. Oh, so that's what is reflected in the Anatta, or that's the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And so as we, an awakened human being then, Form is simply a reference point in the ongoing process of life, but not life, pardon me?
Impermanence.
Within impermanence. And feeling is just another reference point. It's not, so it doesn't, again, this answers that question, well, what happens to me? Don't I need passion? We still have a feeling, but it's no longer a self-referential feeling. It's simply a reference point to what's occurring in your life. Another way, simpler way of saying that might be, you just have an appropriate feeling to what's occurring. So it's not, the world now is, the world isn't devoid, or you're not devoid of the world. You're simply devoid of self-referential expressions in that world. Your feeling just refers you to what's occurring. Is that clear using that terminology? Mm-hmm. Thoughts are the same thing. It's just a reference point. We have gained control of our thinking to what's occurring. We're thinking what we want to think when we want to think it. Mental fabrications are the same thing. Now, we no longer have what I usually refer to or describe mental fabrications as assumptions, but we have thought constructs that are, again, simply reference points to what's occurring. And then our ongoing consciousness is simply an expression of an awakened human being. Again, refer back. It's hard to understand this a little bit or put it in context until you have some examples, like an awakened human being did this. And he lived his life in that mind of equanimity for 45 years. Deeply involved in the world. I mean, he was involved in all the stuff that was going on. You know, he was involved in all the violence and the wars in between these little kingdoms. And he was often asked to advise, what should we do now? So he didn't just awaken and then live in a cave. He was deeply involved in the world. Every day he walked into town and he would converse with the town people. You know, and he would give sometimes little talk, one-on-one talks, and sometimes whole towns would walk to the Buddha. But the point I'm making is he didn't just live in a cave. He was deeply involved in the world. So that idea that what happens to me when I awaken, there's a good example of it. Or Ananda, or Sariputta, or all the other actors, or Dhammadina, or Kemma. They lived incredible lives. Not because of what they acquired. They lived incredible lives because they lived incredible lives. It doesn't need any other description. This is not me. This is not mine. The whole problem of dukkha arises from ignorant eye-making.
Is it all in the past?
Is what?
All referential thoughts are all...
No, I would say they're probably just as much in the future as they are in the past. We're constantly we're usually bouncing between the past and the future, and we're very rarely mindful of what's occurring right now.
Well, when we personalize mental phenomena, we're either trying to manage something that hasn't happened yet, or we're trying to fix something that already happened. So in those places, we're not here. We're reacting to the past.
Can I just ask to try and fix the future, you're relying on a past experience, mm-hmm. or something you've learned in the past that mm-hmm. you bring it forward into the future to try and alter it.
Yep.
The question was, are all referential thoughts in the past?
I understand what you're saying, that the your conditioned thinking that arose from your past experience is now clouding what you think the future may bring to you.
Yes.
So in that sense, yes, all of those thoughts are rooted in the past.
Right.
But we experience them from conditioned thinking of what's going to happen to me. There's that thing,
yes,
you know?
Personalize.
To me, we personalize what's going to happen. You know, it's usually fear or worry, but it can also be the other side. I've done all the right mantras, and tomorrow I'm going to win the lottery. You know, it's just another distraction. Laura, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if it's appropriate to differentiate between thoughts and thinking, like thoughts as kind of this, just in the context of looking at how the Buddha attained control over his thinking, but the thought, my question is, would you imagine that he was still having these thoughts coming in, but he had this control over his thinking that allowed those thoughts to not be a part of his thinking, if that makes any sense?
No, it does. And in the Gara Sutta, he talks about being of two minds, being stuck in that feedback loop. And then post-awakening, he gained the ability to think what he wanted to think when he wanted to think those thoughts. So I think what you're asking me is, did he have an underlying confused train of thought?
Yeah.
And an overriding awakened thought?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think so.
Okay,
He talks about the purity of mind of an awakened human being.
Mm-hmm.
You're no longer troubled by any, and it would make sense because you've now eliminated from yourself any condition that could cause.
Oh my goodness!
Imagine that, right? but Laura, thank you for asking the question, all of you, because that's what we're talking about, developing that purity of mind. And it's not impossible. It's entirely possible. The Buddha was talking also about what you were talking about, Lorna, near or far, present or future. Projecting ourselves into the future and into the past.
Superior, inferior, external.
Yep. He covers the whole gamut of confused thinking there, isn't it? In this really succinct sutta. So now remember, I keep going back to just keep it in your mind. The first sutta was the Four Noble Truths. The second sutta describes the not-self characteristic. Tonight we're going to talk about the end result of not understanding this process, the passion of desire, of continually creating a self.
All those adjectives, near, far, past, present, future, are all related to an I.
Yeah.
Right? They're all fixated in time, in a place. As this is the vehicle that they're in relation to the past, or better, or worse.
Can you say that list again slowly?
So in the book, he says something like, near and far, internal and external,
superior
and inferior. So they're all using this as the placeholder.
Right.
Personalized.
Yeah.
So that what is impermanent is enough. Is not.
And to me, whether this is correct or not, but I just use that not self characteristic to just place these things in context. So when it says something about, they're not self, he's using this teaching for us to be able to utilize it as a skillful means, is what Liz talked about. How do we disengage and become dispassionate and let that fire stop burning around those things that are coming up?
So this is a real good example of that if it's all of those things, how could it possibly be a self?
Mm-hmm.
Look at it this way, in the way that we're bringing up and what Lorna brought up. When you think of yourself in the past, even if it's a moment ago or last week or when you were a little boy or girl, is that a real self? Or is it just an image that you're having of yourself that you're carrying?
Mm-hmm.
There's no self in that. Yeah. It's just a thought.
Just a thought.
That's what the Buddha's referring to. And when we think about tomorrow, we're all going to go up and we're going to have breakfast. There's no reality in that, even though it's likely to occur right now. It's empty of any self, even though we can picture all of us there. In our minds, it seems real, doesn't it? It's like foam on the ocean. It's just a projection. How do we live our lives? How do we live our lives authentically? By responding appropriately to what's occurring. How do we do it?
With right understanding.
With right understanding of what's occurring. It's not a mystery. It's not a mystical experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's a truly authentic experience.
Yeah.
And then you can say, this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. without it being any self-referential views in that. Of course, you wouldn't want to, because you understand the liability of creating a fixed self at that point. You'd have none of that underlying ignorance that would drive that. You're simply present and at peace, no matter what's occurring. For the first time in your life, or maybe millions of lives, if you believe that, you're actually living a life. Why? Because you're present in it. How can you, again, this refers to that, how can it be you if it's impermanent? How can you live your life if you're not there? And how can you be there if, using the Buddha's words, if you're here, there, and everywhere? That's what a self-referential view needs to do. That's what anatta needs to do. It must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that occurs.
I've got one of those.
We all got one of those. That's the monkey mind.
That's also the flame.
Yes.
That is fed yeah. by ignorance, which is yeah. just
yes.
atmosphere. It's everywhere. It's sustaining.
It's like a pilot light, and you yeah. can throw the gasoline on it or not. It's mm-hmm. going to be burning.
Yep.
It's the world, living in this world, there's a pilot light going on.
Yes.
You want to throw gas on it? Good luck.
And tonight we're going to talk about that. The fire is a passion. It's the third cardinal discourse. It's the great discourse, and that place is the hall is a great place to give the teaching.
I have a different kind of question.
Yes, please.
When you go off to college or wherever you go, and you amass all of this knowledge, and you feel like you're the expert of this, and you go back home, and suddenly you're not respected, you know, like, oh, you're still my little brother, my yeah. little sister, my daughter, whatever, you know. So did the Buddha ever go home and get his family?
What a great question. His son and his aunt who raised him, his mother died shortly after birth, both became a monk and a nun in his sangha, both awakened. And throughout his teaching career, he always went back to his dad, King Suddhodana, and taught him the Dhamma. So he didn't remain estranged from his family.
Good.
And they didn't think you
Well, he had one boy, Rahala, okay. before he left home. And right, he left home right when Rahala was a little boy, an infant. Rahula. What was I saying?
Rahala.
Rahala? More knows. I don't. One of my favorite comics of all time was Norm Crosby, and I loved what he did with language. So he destroyed it. Does anybody know who Norm Crosby was? Yeah, that's pretty archaic. And he wasn't well known either. He was no Don Rickles, let me tell you. what was I going to add? So,
John, can I just make a comment?
Sure.
So I think that this is probably why, when you get to that point, you don't need to talk much. There's like not much to say. So, I mean, I have to say this has totally blown my mind, the whole crossover thing. You know, it just, and so when you get to that point where no thoughts are self-referential, that you don't take anything personally, that you're living in a peaceful state because you now have control over your thoughts, which blows me away. There's not a lot of reason to talk a lot.
So what's the image that we all have of the Buddha? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's there to say?
Yeah. What's the other side?
You might ask questions about what's going on with other people, mm-hmm. right? You might really truly be concerned, not from your vantage point, but just like, so, are you going to war today? What's your plan? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a lot of the conversations. Buddha, okay, we're going off to get food. You guys coming? You know?
Isn't that usually what happens when you're quiet? People will say, what are you thinking about?
Liz, you're talking about an awakened expression of right speech. And look at what we have here. This is, again, this is why we have retreats like this, so that we can actually have that experience of what it's like to be an awakened person. You don't have to talk because you're not motivated to talk.
Yeah, I think Keith is enlightened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Kevin. Oh, yes, I learned that before he even came to class.
Kevin is
yeah. There's no reason to do anything that is not appropriate to do. There's no motivation. There's nothing. There's no, again, the need for idle chatter arises from that need to continually establish yourself in a situation. It's coming from a agitated mind. When there's nothing left to agitate the mind, when there's no me, when there's no you here or there or anywhere, what happens? You're not annihilated. You live a life of... The flame is extinguished. Nibbana. That's what it means.
But there's no attachment to anatta. Right?
Anatta is no more. the not-self characteristic is not.
But there's no reason to bring up ideology. There's no reason to bring up ways of defending yourself. There's no... I was in a situation... You know, several years ago, we were responsible for my aunt who had Alzheimer's and was dying, and we did a conference call between my brother, myself, and one of the, I believe it was a social worker at the rehab center, to discuss a plan. And there was such chit-chat and chatter, and I think this, and I think that, and I just decided that I wasn't going to say anything, and then eventually they would ask me what I thought, and I just, because I was exhausted, you know, with the whole process, so they're chit-chatting, and what to do, and I think, and this and that, and I just was like, I had nothing to say unless someone wanted to hear, so it got to the end, and everything quieted down, and there were those 2 seconds of quiet that people felt like they needed to fill, and then I just said what I thought should be done, and conversation ended shortly after that. But I just am completely blown away.
I'm sorry, Liz. Do you mean that in a good way?
I do.
Okay. Because you could be blown away, meaning it was just too much to take in. But you know, I didn't think you would. Saying it that way, it blows me away too, in a lot of different ways. But also that it's really simple when you look at it, but it does blow your mind, or blows a confused mind away. You know, like puts those dandelions, it's gone. You know, there's nothing there. There really isn't. When you start looking at it, we're getting back to that quantum mechanic thing. When you start looking at this with the right view, the right way of thinking, you realize there is nothing here. Why hold on to anything? Because there's nothing, and not because, don't hold on to it because it's useless or it's bad. There's nothing to hold on to. You can hold, I mean, with all your might, but there's still nothing there.
There's nothing. But
wow, when you're holding on to it,
yeah.
But there are conversations that do need to be had, because the aunt still needs a place to be cared for.
Absolutely.
So what I think or how I feel about it is probably relatively irrelevant. Mm-hmm. But what we need to do...
There's a skillfulness that comes from
what is
not
happening.
Engaging in, you know, the anxiety or the sadness.
Mm-hmm.
But just the practicality of
that's
the
discussion. Yeah, what has to happen next?
Yep.
Yep.
And then we'll do that, and then we'll decide what has to happen next, and then we'll figure it out.
Dispassionate points of reference within impermanence.
That's all it is. Yeah. That line in the Vitakasanthana Sutta: "You think what you want to think when you want to think it." What follows from that is the ability to act appropriately when it's time to act appropriately, and of course, to practice restraint. You know, it's another, you know, I won't give that talk, but the essence of all this is to learn how to practice restraint. That's why right speech is so valuable. You know?
There's often times that we may get what we don't want, which means that we may have to be driving back and forth somewhere, because that's what needs to be done.
And if you don't take it,
move away from our, I can't, you know, we can do it.
If you don't take it personally, you can just say thank you.
You can also recognize how difficult the situation is on its own without contributing to the situation to make it work. Mm-hmm. You know, and at the end of the day, you know, Helen and my brother and I were able to say, and having done this for the first time with no reference point and no wise person guiding us, we were able to say we made a good choice at every juncture, and we were respectful of each other and of each other's time and of what each other's responsibilities were. My brother used to say, we'll jump off that bridge when we get to it. And that was, you know, that was his way of, you know, having a reference point, but being able to disengage the tension, you know, and then allow us to think, you know, what is the best thing for her? What is the best thing for us? You know, what's the most compassionate thing we can do? In all reference points, you know, what my brother needed, what Helen needed, what I needed, what my mother needed, and what Betsy needed. So, you know, not making it worse. And doing it just from our own instincts, you know, is reassuring.
Not contributing to the suffering that's already present. Wow, what another wonderful, it's really remarkable what's occurring here this week, and I hope you all notice it too. I certainly do. It's even a little after 11:30, so lunch is soon. Do you have a Qigong session this afternoon?
At 1:30.
And probably be down here?
Down here or in the big hall no one's there.
You're able to use the big hall if you want. So there won't be an afternoon session down here for me. So enjoy your right speech and enjoy your solitude.
We can come sit if we want to.
The whole facility is for you. Again, if you want to talk to me, I'm always available. I might take a little nap this afternoon, but you can always knock on my door. We're going to be in the big hall this afternoon tonight too.
That's it.